Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Coming up on the program, in several states, Sequel Youth and Family Services is under investigation for abuse. There are concerns about their juvenile treatment facility in Wyoming as well.
I would just like to see NSI kind of tighten up their security and do a better job with the kids down there.
The life of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg had an impact on some Wyoming attorneys and judges.
For me, you know, as a young woman and a young attorney, set the example for the fact that there are no limits and we can do things.
After a fatal grizzly bear human encounter near Jackson, Teton County decided they may need to figure out a different approach to respond to these types of incidents. Join us for those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Journalists with APM Reports have been investigating a pattern of abuse and harm at juvenile treatment centers run by Sequel Youth and Family Services. The company has facilities across the country, including one in Wyoming. Reporter Tennessee Watson teamed up with APM Reports to look at Wyoming's response to concerns about Sequel's facility in Sheridan and brings us this story.
As the crow flies, Normative Services Institute, or NSI, is less than 5 miles from Philip Huckins and Jane Clark's ranch, but it isn't easy terrain to cross.
I tell you what, you can wear a horse out on those hills right there pretty easy.
And yet on May 4th, 2018, while out on an early morning stroll, Huckins discovered a runaway from the juvenile treatment facility hiding in his corral.
And I told him, I said, now stay down on your hands and knees, don't get up.
Huckins sized the kid up and determined he wasn't a threat. He seemed terrified and cold after a night out in nothing but a tank top and shorts with no shoes. So Huckins brought him inside, and while his wife, Jane Clark, cooked the weary traveler a hot breakfast, he called the sheriff. Eventually, a deputy arrived and took the kid back to NSI.
Like I said, I kind of felt sorry for him, you know. He wasn't antagonistic. Every time he answered me was yes, sir, no, sir. You know, he was polite.
But Huckins and Clark, like many Wyomingites, have guns. If the kid had been aggressive, they say things could have gone much worse. Huckins says it's on NSI to make sure a tragedy like that doesn't occur.
Because I think they have a place in the community, but I would just like to see NSI kind of tighten up their security and do a better job with the kids down there.
And they aren't the only ones who feel this way. Last year, Sheridan residents started using Facebook to share their concerns about NSI runaways. One commenter said her car was stolen and severely damaged. Another warned that he would, quote, just lock and load, shoot on sight, close quote. Others voiced sympathy for the traumatic lives these kids had lived. The public outcry got the attention of the Sheridan County Commissioners, who took the matter up with NSI's management. Gary Floor, NSI's director at the time, shared plans to improve security.
We're going to put a 10-foot non-climb fence across the back of the property.
Floor added he was installing more security cameras. Commissioner Christy Haswell says that after those changes were made, there was a decline in runaways. From Haswell's perspective, the work of the commission was done.
If we're not hearing from the community, it's none of our business, frankly.
But issues haven't gone away entirely. They're just harder for the community to see. In 2019, the Sheridan County Sheriff's Office got 25 calls for runaways and 2 for violence at NSI. So far in 2020, the numbers have flipped, with 6 calls for runaways and 28 for violence at the facility. Sheriff Alan Thompson has a theory. He says traumatized kids respond to stress with the most basic human instinct, fight or flight.
And when they take away the flight, then it makes sense that the fight increases.
And that theory raises concern about whether the root causes of these kids' stress are being addressed at NSI. Thompson says that's a good question, but evaluating NSI's treatment protocol is beyond his authority. What he can do is keep an eye out for abuse and mistreatment at the facility.
We have unfettered access to the NSI campus and can ensure that those types of things aren't occurring there.
Still, Thompson and the commissioners felt limited in their ability to address deeper issues at NSI. Last year, they wrote to the Wyoming Department of Family Services to see if the state could intervene. Director Corinne Schmidt wrote back explaining that she shared concerns about the runaways, but despite that, NSI was still in compliance with licensing requirements. In a more recent interview, Schmidt acknowledged the criteria are narrow.
The room and board, the safety, the physical plant, food, those issues.
But as for NSI's internal culture or the effectiveness of the treatment,
no, that's really not our job. And we are not therapists. We are not clinicians. We are not mental health experts.
Schmidt says the market is the best check.
While we have some responsibility to make sure the kids are safe, there's also people who are paying for that service from that particular facility. So is it our business then to go in and make therapeutic decisions on behalf of their program?
The thinking is if the service isn't good, then judges and schools and parents will stop spending their money with NSI. And that's what happened in Wyoming. Over the last 10 years, the number of Wyoming kids placed at NSI has steadily declined from over 50 in 2011 to just 3 in 2020. So if Wyoming isn't buying NSI services, then who is? The facility's biggest customer is Montana. State officials declined an interview. In a written statement, they explain that facilities have to meet requirements concerning treatment and therapeutic interventions, but they didn't give details on how those requirements are enforced. NSI management also declined an interview, but Sequel's PR firm provided a written statement saying, quote, "The road to healing is often a complex and intricate process, and we are committed to helping our residents succeed," close quote. That's coming from a company whose facilities are under investigation in multiple states and whose staff killed a young man at a treatment center in Michigan less than 6 months ago. Here in Wyoming, it remains unclear who's empowered to make sure Sequel fulfills its commitment to kids placed at NSI. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
This story was produced in collaboration with APM Reports. Find a link to their investigation of Sequel on our website. Additional reporting was done by Ada Uzunlar. The death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg certainly has some political repercussions, but for many women who followed her career, her impact will be long-lasting. That's certainly the case for many women who practiced law, who had doors open for them, thanks to the perseverance of Justice Ginsburg.
Justice Ginsburg was certainly one who, for me, you know, as a young woman and a young attorney, set the example for the fact that there are no limits and we can do things.
That's Wyoming Supreme Court Justice Lynn Bumgarten. And in her career, she's certainly done things. Bumgarten is the former director of the Office of State Lands and Investments and even became the first woman to serve on the Cheyenne Frontier Day's General Committee. Bumgarten says while Justice Ginsburg did a lot for women, her work as an attorney on discrimination issues is as important as her time on the Supreme Court. She says a lot of the laws and policies we have today were due to that early work.
For me, her importance as a champion is more for diversity generally, even, you know, above and beyond just gender equality, but she's a champion for diversity.
Casper attorney Anna Olson first became aware of Justice Ginsburg while in high school. She says Ginsburg's approach of chipping away at an issue led to bigger successes later. She says there is no greater example than her efforts on same-sex discrimination.
Those little cases would build onto each other so that by the time we were ready for the gay rights marriage case, America was ready for it. She didn't just do it in take that case out of the chute. So I think she really was brilliant in her fight for equality as well.
Olson adds she was fascinated with Ginsburg since she was a teenager and remembers reading an article where Ginsburg discussed the importance of women being independent.
I took that as meaning that means that I can go out there and get a job and be completely independent. And I don't need to be relying on my spouse or my partner to provide for me, because I'll be able to take care of myself. And that really was a profound moment for me.
Laramie attorney Donna Platon is the community municipal judge. She says Justice Ginsburg impacted her work in many ways. Platon established the UW College of Law Family and Child Legal Advocacy Clinic and has done a lot of work with the Wyoming Coalition Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Platon is someone who mentors a number of young attorneys, and she hopes they understand what doors Justice Ginsburg opened.
I think there's a disconnect sometimes between understanding that this happened in my lifetime, that women were given rights that men always had. And I just don't know if younger lawyers appreciate that, both men and women.
While there is still work to be done, Platon notes that the Wyoming Supreme Court has more women than men sitting on its bench, and about half of UW's law school graduating classes have women in them. She attributes that to efforts by people just like Justice Ginsburg. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck. When we come back, we will turn our attention to music, specifically the Wyomericana Caravan. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to the Kids Ask Why podcast,
where kids ask the questions.
Can snow push stuff down into the ground?
What stuff? Like bugs?
Maybe houses?
Well...
For our first season, 15 kids ask adults hard questions to find out more about why they think Wyoming is special. Look for the first episode of Kids Ask Why on Tuesday, October 6th, under podcast at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. The Wyomericana Caravan is back on the road after a hiatus of just a few years. It began back in 2013 as a traveling concert, showcasing some of Wyoming's finest singer-songwriters and musicians. The tour was named the top arts entertainment event of 2013 by the Casper Star Tribune, and also received a full-page spread in the New York Times. Wyoming Public Radio's Grady Kirkpatrick recently spoke with the co-founder and producer Aaron Davis about the return of the Wyomericana Caravan.
We were thrilled to hear about the return of the caravan at the beginning of the year, and then, of course, COVID hit, so plans and shows had to be scaled back. How did it go, first couple of shows?
They went really well. You know, we started it off in Sheridan at the Wyo Theater, and, you know, this tour has always done really well in theaters because we've been able to have the space backstage to rehearse together, and also the space on stage to be able to play our encore sets. So the Wyo Theater was a perfect example of that. It was just really inspiring sets from everyone.
That's great. I expect COVID precautions are in place at the venues where you're playing.
Yes. The Wyo Theater did a great job of spreading everybody out. Everybody came in masked, and the staff and the musicians were all playing it safe as well. And I think it really relies not just on the venue precautions based on the state regulations, but also the audience that's coming. It really depends on the due diligence of everybody to keep it a little more mellow than we normally would.
Well, as usual, you have some very talented singer-songwriters along. Tell us about the lineup this year.
Oh, man, I'm so excited about this lineup. You know, it's cool because Jason Tyler Burton and I know each other and have over the years and done some projects together. And then Sean Hess, and he's traveling with fiddle player Jackson Clarendon, who's a Laramie local and plays in several projects there. And so he's traveling as a duo on this tour. And it really just fits his sound so well. You know, he's one of the very few genuine country acts that comes to mind that I've seen around in recent years, and now seeing him live after the first couple shows just really puts on a great set.
Well, I once had a little angel. She made me feel so nice, and I once thought her heart was made of gold, but it was filled with ice. And when things for her and I flew south, honey, so did she. And it took so long just to realize she was never even good to me.
John Hess and World Away. Sean, part of the Wyomericana Caravan. Fellow Kentucky transplant Jason Tyler Burton, based in Pinedale, is also part of the caravan. You worked with Jason on his most recent album, Kentucky, and I believe took first place among Wyoming Sounds listeners, Best of Wyoming, for 2019. Do you and Jason share similar experiences as musicians hailing from Kentucky with that really rich tradition of music?
Yeah, I think so. And we've talked about this too. His album, Kentuckian, I just love it so much. We did most of the tracking here at my place in Hoback in my studio. And I just really love this album. And it's a testament to Jason's writing. And he performs them so well too. He's a really witty performer, and playing these songs in a solo format that he's doing on this tour really hones in on the messages, I think. And yeah, really, really stoked to do this. Is the first tour that we've done together, and our background of collaborating just makes it that much more fun. So
cool.
Awesome to have him on board.
I remember when the floodgates came to Pine. They keep out the water, but another flood.
Jason Tyler Burton, High Road to Harlan, and I'm talking with Aaron Davis, the Wyomericana Caravan, back on the road this late summer into early fall. Aaron, you've partnered with the Wyoming Arts Council. How did that collaboration come about?
Well, the conversation started, I'd say, back in 2016. We started the tour in 13.
Mm-hmm.
And the Arts Council, they had reached out about wanting to support it in a non-monetary way originally. And then around the last tour, what was going to be the last tour in 2017, they talked about helping us out funding-wise and taking on more of a role there. And it just didn't come to fruition. And so it's always been very much a grassroots tour where all the artists assume some sort of level of risk together. And so that's really been an interesting pact, I mm-hmm. think, with the artists, because it's so hard to put, you know, a dozen or so musicians on the road together anywhere, especially in the rural places that we travel to. So this year, the Wyoming Arts Council collaboration, so important to this year and these times. We are live streaming a couple of these shows, and it's become an important asset to the venues to be able to support the artists through live streaming. So though a lot of the artists have been live streaming from their living rooms for free, I think, you know, our future is kind of looking at more of a ticketed based live stream system to be able to make these shows happen. And so I think that formula moving forward is going to be a way for fans to really support this tour and support artists in general and venues, because it's going to take a lot of support from these local communities to be able to continue to do shows.
Again, talking with Aaron Davis of the Wyomericana Caravan, Aaron Davis and the Mystery Machine, and you played shows in Sheridan and Pinedale. Tell us about the upcoming shows for early October.
Yeah, we have a 4-show run, and they're all in Wyoming. It's going to start in Jackson on October 1st, and then we're going down to Rock Springs October 2nd, then Cheyenne at the Lincoln Theater on Saturday, October 3rd. And then we're going to close the tour in Laramie at the Griffin Theater on October 4th.
It's great to have you back and playing music in front of audiences. And more information at WyomericanaCaravan.com, right?
Yes.
Aaron Davis, yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Grady. Appreciate it, as always.
This is the time of year we ask for support for all of our news and cultural affairs programming. Please support this program and all that you appreciate from Wyoming Public Media with your pledge of support. When we come back, Governor Gordon went to Washington this week in an effort to reform the Endangered Species Act. We will have that story and a look at a local approach on how to deal with animal attacks. This is Open Spaces.
This season on The Modern West, my hometown of Walden, Colorado has been shrinking. Schools are closing. Times are hard. My parents are even deciding whether to move away.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to say they're going to take me out feet first. You know, I'm going to do whatever needs to be done, right?
I'm Melody Edwards. Join me for Ghost Towning, a look at rural decline and resilience. Find The Modern West under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon was in the nation's capital this week testifying about his desire to overhaul the Endangered Species Act. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story on his testimony calling to upend that act, a message he delivered before Wyoming Senator John Barrasso's Environment and Public Works Committee.
Governor Gordon and Senator Barrasso teamed up this week to try and give Wyoming and other states more control over how the Endangered Species Act is implemented. And Governor Gordon made sure to tell Barrasso and his committee about the historic 11-state agreement reached in 2015 to save sage-grouse.
Involving private landowners, government agencies, non-governmental entities, industry, citizens, and all with the common aim of protecting the largest concentration of remaining grouse habitat in the country. It's working. Northeastern Wyoming sage-grouse populations have improved of late, something that I can attest to from seeing the birds in my own hall pasture over the course of the past year.
But there seems to be a flaw in Governor Gordon's testimony. Sage-grouse are witnessing an alarming decline in population, according to environmentalists. In fact, just this week, the Center for Biological Diversity and Western Watersheds Project alerted federal agencies they plan to sue the federal government within 60 days unless the government reverses these trends. Still, this Wednesday, Gordon testified that the sage-grouse program should be expanded to two contentious larger mammals.
Wyoming is home to several lightning rod species. Species like the carnivores that command national and international attention. The gray wolf and the grizzly bear have a marquee value that is mesmerizing. Perversely, some organizations who set forth to do good work found the fundraising appeal of these stars irresistible.
4 years ago, Barrasso got to work on this overhaul, which is now titled the Endangered Species Act Amendments of 2020.
Our stakeholder feedback process made clear that at least one provision in my bill is a non-starter for those groups and for the committee's minority. It also made clear that the same provision is the top priority for my home state of Wyoming.
Barrasso now has a new target in his sights, and it's not necessarily the grizzly bears he wants delisted. It's the courts that have protected them.
The grizzly bear in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem is fully recovered. That's not just me saying it. President Bush, President Obama, and President Trump all agree. And each of those administrations have tried to delist the species. Yet, activist federal judges have repeatedly intervened to overturn these delisting rules.
Barrasso's legislation would delay the ability of any federal court to overturn any delisting decision over a 5-year period where the animals would be monitored. But the top Democrat on the Environment Committee, Tom Carper of Delaware, doesn't like Barrasso's proposal.
Fortunately, the Endangered Species Act is one of our nation's best tools to support, improve, and protect biodiversity.
And Carper and other Democrats think Barrasso's legislation would be moving backwards.
But over the course of the last two Congresses, I've learned how and why Delaware's experience and perspective is vastly different from some other states, including Wyoming, on this particular issue. But having said that, I still struggle to fully understand how this legislation would support species recovery or serve the American public in Delaware or in most other states.
The debate over the Endangered Species Act has only heated up here in Washington since the death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And subsequently, President Trump and Senate Republicans rushed to quickly fill the seat with a conservative. Here's North Dakota Republican Senator Kevin Cramer.
A lot of people are wondering what's going to be the main issue when you talk to President Trump's next nominee to the Supreme Court of the United States. Mine is going to be this issue. That is, what is the proper role of states with our federal government in our federalist system? Because I think we've lost track of it.
Democrats say that's insane. New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker says the Endangered Species Act is needed now more than ever before.
We are in one of the handful, going back to the dinosaurs, one of the handful of global extinction crises. It's estimated right now that one in six species are threatened with extinction in this century alone. One in six.
Barrasso is chair, though, and he knows the politics on climate change have rapidly evolved in recent years. He says he's willing to listen to those critics, but Barrasso isn't going to move a bill that doesn't upend the Endangered Species Act as we know it.
Stakeholders have also sought a significant additional funding stream for wildlife conservation. I continue to be open to exploring this possibility. The funding levels must be reasonable, justified, and paid for. They must also be part of a bill that modernizes the Endangered Species Act.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Staying with the topic of wildlife, grizzly bear human encounters have increased in the past decade. After a fatal attack, one community decided to become better prepared to respond to animal attacks in the backcountry. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska has that story.
You know, it all began with an incident that we had 2 years ago where we had an outfitter and his client that were involved in a grizzly attack.
That's Teton County Sheriff Matt Carr, who says his office was notified by the client who had fled the scene.
We knew the guide had been attacked. We were losing daylight. It was trying to decide, how do we safely insert a team into this situation, knowing that there's been an attack, that there are grizzlies.
Carr says search and rescue was able to find the client, but by that time it was dark. A situation made more dangerous by the presence of a grizzly sow and a cub or two. So they decided to hold off till the next light to try to find the outfitter. He was found the next day, dead.
Oh, it was just trying to think of the best scenario on the fly. It was nothing that we had planned for.
Carr says during the incident review, they realized search and rescue has response plans for all different situations.
We have a swift water response plan. We have an avalanche rescue plan. We have a cave rescue response plan. So why not look at this, because it's an incident that seems to be happening on a, unfortunately, more regular basis with these encounters. We should look at it from that approach.
That approach was the decision to create a specialized response team just for animal attacks in the backcountry. AJ Wheeler is one of the search and rescue volunteers.
We are a team within the team, which is not the normal paradigm for Teton County Search and Rescue. We generally try to train all of our rescuers in every discipline. Because of the specialized nature of this team, it is a limited selection.
15 volunteers made up of Wyoming Game and Fish, search and rescue members, and sheriff officers had to go through physical, firearm, and animal behavior training.
We are constantly training our fitness, so we're all expected to keep our fitness up. We've had trainings with Wyoming Game and Fish on animal behavior and how to stay away from aggressive animals, but identifying animal attack patterns and those kinds of things.
With the goal of reaching the individual as quickly as possible in order to try to save their life. In addition to identifying animal attack patterns, Wyoming Game and Fish's Brian DeBolt says the team has been taught how to prepare the scene for an investigation.
Kind of things to look for to determine what the cause of the attack may have been. Again, is it just a normal defensive attack? which is most common, and why? You know, are there cubs present? Is there some sort of food source present? All these things that they need to be aware of as to what may have provoked this attack.
Not only does this help the team provide information for a game and fish investigation, but first responders are better aware of the situation they are walking into.
And these are the things you need to be aware of and be on the lookout for so you don't put yourself in a dangerous situation. And we don't have an additional victim, one of the first responders. We don't want those folks to end up a victim as well.
As more people are recreating in the backcountry, it could lead to more encounters with wildlife. This year alone has seen a high increase of human grizzly bear encounters, none fatal so far. But AJ Wheeler says usually hunting season is when these type of encounters are most likely to occur.
And just the nature of hunters and where hunters are, you know, we definitely see an uptick in animal encounters. And that's really the area that we're looking to be able to deploy this team to protect our teammates who are, you know, performing the search and rescue function.
Wheeler says only time will tell if their new approach pays off. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kodalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Let's completely change gears and talk about movies. As statewide public health orders aimed at slowing the spread of the coronavirus are being lifted over time, more public events are resuming. Many film festivals around the world have had to cancel or change their formats to limit risks. But for the WIO Film Festival in Sheridan, the shows will go on in person with some modifications. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler spoke with the festival's director, Justin Stroop.
When we started the WIO Film Festival, the idea behind it was that people in Wyoming and the West have always loved a good story. I mean, so much so that we built an entire mythos around what the West is. Like, how meta is that, right? So we wanted to, first and foremost, just have films that were people wouldn't necessarily have access to because of our region. We don't get access to a lot of more art-style films, more independent films. So we wanted to bring those films in with a focus on films that had a great story. Strong stories, strong characters, and that's basically where we started.
What's kind of the feedback that you've received so far from people, you know, over the years?
When they go to the movies, they seem really surprised that they, I guess I should take this as a compliment, that they really like the movies. I don't know if they expected to not like the movie going, which I guess thanks for coming to the festival expecting not to like it. I've had people say that it's really kind of changed the types of movies that they'll maybe even be willing to watch. So I think it's brought people, it's kind of opened people's minds a little bit.
I know you guys made the decision to, you know, keep this in person this year. What went into that? And
yeah.
What kinds of precautions and different guidelines are you following?
We're just very lucky because of the size of the venue that we've got. And the capabilities of that venue that we can do that. And then coupled with, you know, we just kind of made the decision that if we're going to do this, we have to do it in person. Otherwise, let's take the year off and not do it because it just philosophically wouldn't match up with what we were trying to do. So I think by default, we've been able to do that. We really took the responsibility of trying to do this in the most responsible way possible for everybody's safety. In the lobby area of the theater, folks have to wear masks. So masks are required in that area because we can't guarantee social distancing guidelines can be followed just because it's a smaller space and people will kind of bottleneck through there. Once people are in the theater in their seats, we'll be following social distancing guidelines there so people will be in reserved seats that have been spaced appropriately to follow those social distancing guidelines. So the capacity of the theater has actually been reduced by about two-thirds. But, you know, we get to sit in the same room with other people and laugh together and cry together and react to films together. And there's that community aspect of film that isn't quite the same when you're sitting alone in front of a computer screen.
And I guess on the topic of the actual festival, what films or, you know, short films are you super excited for and are really happy are going to be here this year?
So I think the easiest answer to that is all of them, because I had to pick them. So it's like picking a favorite child. But after that, I would say Bastards Road is really towards the top of my list, if I had to make a list. It's an incredible story about a combat veteran, Marine combat veteran, Jonathan Hancock, and his 6,000 mile walk across the country. I've actually been trying to get this film to be part of the festival since the first year. You know, it's a funny film. It's a heartwarming film. It's such an incredible message, both for you know, our veterans that may be dealing with PTSD and other issues, but also as a person that was not in the military and really has no conception of what that life is like, to give us as outsiders to that culture a way to kind of break the ice and be able to start that conversation. But yeah, our shorts are great. There's about 14 films that are incredible this year.
That was Catherine Wheeler and Wyoming Film Festival Director Justin Stroop. The festival kicks off Friday, October 2nd in Sheridan. Coming up in the program, we will speak to the author of a new book on Heart Mountain, and we will hear how the UW Symphony is dealing with pandemic restrictions. This is Open Spaces.
While you're on a road trip, it'd be weird to be in the car with 81 ducks or 81 lit candles. That's a fire hazard. But 81 Human Nature podcast episodes, that would make your road trip amazing.
We could have probably, you know, power walked faster.
I'm like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I'm gonna hit this bear.
I'm Erin Jones. Binge all 81 Human Nature episodes under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Nestled in between Cody and Powell in northwestern Wyoming, the Heart Mountain Interpretive Center tells the story of over 10,000 Japanese Americans who were held in the internment camp against their will during World War II. It turns out the museum would not exist if it weren't for the formerly incarcerated and their children's dedication. Chair of the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation, Shirley Ann Hugochi, just released her new book, Setsuko's Secret, Telling These Stories. To start, Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska asks Hugochi how she learned about her parents' time at Heart Mountain.
I always knew sort of in the back of my mind that my parents spent time at Heart Mountain Camp, but my mother always framed it as a fun place to be, a place where she met my father, and never really talked about the negative aspects. Even the issues of, like, you know, having her appendix removed in the Barrack Dusty Hospital in Wyoming, she kind of glossed it over as sort of going to a doctor's appointment and getting her her appendix out. So I always feel that a lot of ways the Japanese American incarceration has been whitewashed in our society. And I think the Nisei, the generation that my parents are, second generation Japanese Americans, have been sort of whitewashed and told to sort of minimize that experience.
Yeah, and one of the things that stood out to me the most was that one of your mom's dying wish was to have an actual museum on the site. Why is that significant for Japanese Americans?
After Ronald Reagan had signed the reparation bill, which really kind of apologized to the Japanese Americans, I think the Japanese American community felt permission to actually speak about this experience. And so the idea of building something to remember that experience, memorialize not only their feelings and thoughts, but also the fact that that event actually occurred. So I think the building of the Heart Mountain Museum, as well as what we do in Cody Powell, Wyoming, is a real significant step, not only for the state of Wyoming, but I think our nation, to recognize an injustice that basically our government has acknowledged as being wrong, which is a really important step that a country is brave enough to apologize for missteps in the past. So it's very important.
How is the story that you tell in the book different from the traditional Heart Mountain story?
Well, I really think that this book is extremely effective because it's a combination of a memoir and a well-researched historical academic book. But I think the concept of being a memoir, it explores the area of the multi-generational trauma and the effect on my generation being the daughter of an incarceree who was never incarcerated herself, but has been able to sort of experience through the lives of my family members and my parents. And I think the problem is when any kind of trauma occurs and you're taught or told not to talk about it, it really informs the way you are as an adult. And those qualities or those attributes are passed down to your children. But if the children don't understand why your mother is controlling or why your mother has this need for perfection. I remember my best girlfriend who lived across the street while I was growing up, she told me, "I can't believe what your mother told my mother." But what she said is that my mother told the next door neighbor that if Shirley can't be a doctor or a lawyer, it doesn't matter because she could marry one. And to hear that from your girlfriend when you're only age 11, what does that do to your confidence or your desire to be somebody, but somebody's wife? And then there's nothing wrong with that, but it's really not about what other people want for young girls growing up. It's really what that young girl wants. And to sort of kind of not get what you want because of what your parents had to go through or didn't have, and that shapes who you are, you know, I think that could be very damaging.
And you mentioned that this has a lot to do with the present day and news. How do you hope people will receive it today?
If you look at the current immigration policies, if you look at the rounding up of children and being placed in detention camps, you know, because of their immigration status and what's happening in their lives, those experiences are not that much different than what happened to the Japanese American. So, you know, the United States and the world has this uncanny ability to continuously repeat over and over again the same mistakes, which is really unfortunate. So hopefully this could be a learning tool on what not to do during wartime crisis, during a COVID crisis, during any form of crisis where, you know, we have the tendency to turn on each other and on the others when things are stressful. And we have to really step back from that impulse.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudalska speaking with the author of the new book called Setsuko Secret, and that was Shirley Higuchi. The coronavirus pandemic has been particularly disruptive for musicians. Some solo performers and small ensembles have figured out creative ways to keep performing. But for symphony orchestras, which can have upwards of 80 players on stage, the problem of safe performances is especially complex. The University of Wyoming Symphony Orchestra has its first fall concert scheduled for October 1st. As he explained to Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer, figuring out a way forward has been occupying conductor Michael Griffith's time.
The first live concert that gave us all hope was the Berlin Philharmonic. And they did the Mahler Symphony No. 4, but they did an arrangement for something like 20 players. And they were just spread all over their huge, huge stage. And it was both a very exciting relief to see, wow, live music is happening again, but then there was a, and this is what it's going to be like. A Mahler symphony with 20 players, it's a great arrangement. I enjoyed it. We may do it in the spring. But nevertheless, it was, okay, this is life these days. And we had to look at it not as what a letdown, but how fascinating.
And it's, of course, worth considering that the orchestra, the symphony orchestra, as we imagine it, reached its mature form around Mahler's day.
Exactly.
A very large orchestra. Mm-hmm. But if you go back 100, 200 years, mm-hmm. you're looking at much smaller ensembles.
I would say what we think of as a full-size symphony orchestra started in the early 1800s as, a couple of factors. One, concerts became more and more for the public rather than just for royalty, and therefore ticket sales were important, and therefore the size of the hall got bigger. And then to fill a hall like that, the ensemble got bigger.
And so by necessity, now you are having to split the orchestra into smaller sections. Tell me a bit about how this is going to work for these two concerts you have this fall.
First of all, there'll be, at least in the fall semester, there'll be no audience, just live streamed. The strings and percussionists, anybody who's not a wind player, must be 6 feet, 8 inches apart and wearing a mask. Woodwind and brass players must be 10 feet apart, and we have a certain special kind of mask that has a little flap on it so they can get their mouthpiece in their mouth, but still any air that might be exhaled around the mouthpiece or out of the nose is not getting pushed far away from them.
How much room is there on stage? I mean, how many musicians can you fit on stage?
Well, it varies depending on the orchestration. The more winds I use, the fewer strings. What I've been trying to do is choose music that uses no more than 7 woodwinds or brass. And I'm actually conducting from the third row of the auditorium so that I don't take space on stage from one of the players.
So you're thinking about the orchestra in very different ways than you would have a year ago. And then, of course, the arrangements as well.
The repertoire is totally different. Interesting that you use the word arrangement there, because some of the music that I've chosen was originally written for that small an orchestra. And I'm doing exactly what the composer wrote. My first concert in the spring, which is not until March, is going to be the Mahler Symphony No. 4. Now, if we have a vaccine by then, or if we have a cure, or for whatever reason, all the great stuff happens, and I can put the whole orchestra on stage, then we will do Mahler Symphony 4 exactly as Mahler wrote it. On the other hand, if we're still in this socially distancing orchestra thing, then I'm going to do the exact same arrangement that the Berlin Philharmonic reopened of this Mahler arranged for 20 players. You must understand, it's not you just leave players out.
Right.
Somebody had to rewrite it so that the second flute part is covered by somebody else and so on.
While we're talking about repertoire, you're not only responding to the public health situation, you're also responding to what's happening socially and politically in the country.
Absolutely. The world of symphony orchestra tends very much to be of dead white males. And maybe in the 20th century, some are not dead, and more females. But it has been, the perception has been that it's white people a lot. Over the years, I've tried very, very hard to do a lot of works by female composers, and I think we have done that. Because of my contacts in Brazil and a time that when the orchestra took a trip to Bolivia, we've done quite a few works by Latinx composers, but not so much black composers. And what's been going on in the world these days made me come, and many people in the world of orchestral music come to the realization that we really need to think about this much more. And We have three works by Black composers. So I think we are trying to address what perhaps had been, no, not even perhaps, what had been a lack in the orchestral repertoire the world over, to try to make up for that a little bit.
Now, I want to go back to this idea of you conducting from the third row and these musicians spaced out on stage, because typically when one thinks of a smaller ensemble, usually the word intimacy comes up. But I imagine that's not quite the feel when you're spread out. You know, if you have 20 people spread out across a football field, that's not going to feel very intimate versus 20 people in a small room.
It's going to be what it's going to be, and we're going to work very hard to make it work. I have no idea what it's going to be like yet, because we have not rehearsed all together. We've rehearsed the 3 second violins on Zoom with their section leader unmuted and the other two players muted.
Because of lag issues.
Exactly. We get back on Monday the 28th. We have rehearsal Tuesday evening and Wednesday evening, concert Thursday. I can hope that everybody's learned their part at that point, so when we put it together, it works. I tried very hard and I think succeeded at choosing repertoire that works in this format. So this is not repertoire that's watered down. This is repertoire that was constructed in a different way.
And to loop all the way back to your experience with the Berlin Philharmonic and this reimagined Mahler, it's not just something watered down, as you say, it's a different experience, and there's value in that too.
Exactly. And you listen for a little bit and you think, where's the mass sound? But pretty soon you go, oh, listen to that interplay between player A and player B that maybe when there's 100 players on stage, you wouldn't hear. And so it is not a denigrated experience, simply a different experience.
Michael Griffith is the conductor of the University of Wyoming Symphony. It has live stream performances scheduled for October 1st and November 19th. You can hear more of the conversation, including how these changes are affecting the student experience, on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. You can hear the entire show again on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org or just individual segments. The program is also available via podcast, and a rater is our web editor. Get segments from this show and all of our news stories by following the station Facebook page or our Twitter feed. And please continue to support this program and our Wyoming news coverage with your pledge on our website. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.